May it please the court?
Certainly.
Opposing counsel? The issue for you to decide is when a potential juror states under oath that they are confident they are probably biased for one side and they are never asked follow-up questions about being fair or impartial. Only, quote, will you do your level best, unquote, has the potential juror been rehabilitated? And more importantly, can a juror be rehabilitated once they have stated they are confident in their bias for a litigant? Because if a juror confident in their bias can be rehabilitated, specifically by merely asking, will you do your best? If that is the law, then they win and we lose. At the most fundamental level, Section 1 bias is a bias in favor of or against a party litigant that may influence a juror's judgment. Section 2 bias, at its most fundamental level, is an ideological bias that rises to the level of inability to follow the court's instructions.
What is your authority for making that distinction between subsection 1 and subsection 2 bias?
Subsection 1 specifically states that no person who has formed or expressed an opinion concerning the matter or material in controversy. So we're talking about the specifics of the case. I mean, the very language of the statute is specifics of the case.
Do you have cases from this court that have interpreted it in that manner?
Joy versus Morrison did so indirectly when it discussed the fact that The lawyer was, I think, was somewhat off on the analysis because they thought they had a Section 1 bias. And the court said, no, these are general biases. There were questions asked in Joy v. Morrison about lawsuits in general, about the McDonald's coffee case, and would that cause problems? There's too much money being awarded. Again, these were general questions. The attorney in that case said that was a Section 1 bias. The defense said no, that was a Section 2 bias, and the court agreed with the defense in that case and said that was a Section 2 bias. Specifically, I have not found any specific cases from the Supreme Court of Missouri on this issue, so I'm glad that the court is hearing this because I think we need some guidance on this topic. In this specific case, we have a juror, when asked of the whole panel, just the whole panel, does anybody have any biases or may start off in favor of the defendant, there were hands that went up when circled back. So that's the first time she indicates a potential or probable bias. Then when she's asked specifically, acknowledged, she is asked if she would start off touch in favor of the defendant. She says, yeah, probably. That's the second time she's indicated a bias. She's then asked again in follow-up, would you be slightly in favor of them? She again says, yeah, probably. That's the third time she said she's biased. And then finally, to stop beating this dead horse, she's asked, are you confident in this answer that you're probably biased? And she says, yes. That's the fourth time now she said she's biased. In fact, she says she's confident in her bias. Then later on, now, so this, I think, addresses the Section 1. Has she formed or expressed an opinion concerning any material fact in controversy? And she has, in this particular case, as these questions are developed, she's asked about her relationship to her sister, who worked 25 years with Mercy Hospital. She referred to it as Big Mercy, and this is Little Mercy, because everybody in the community knows Mercy refers to Mercy. SSM refers to SSM. There's a relationship.
Your Honor. Alleged conduct involved Big Mercy or Big St. John's?
No, it did not. It involved Little Mercy, or St. John's, as she called it, too.
So is that fact significant, that any contact or any opinion she expressed was limited to Big Mercy or Big St. John's?
I don't believe it was, because she asked if they were related or they were the same thing at one point. So in the juror's mind, and I think the defense has pointed out, in the trial there were no allegations of negligence against Big Mercy or Big St. John's, but in the juror's minds they're one entity. And so she said she would be biased because of her relationship with St. John's, or as we clarified later, Mercy. She then goes, and I think that's an important point that you brought up, Your Honor, because it's what is the juror's thought process, not, in fact, even if that was wrong. We know, in fact, the Mercies are related, but in fact, what if it was wrong? They were not related at all. the fact that she in her mind believes they are related then continues that bias over to the party litigant in this case, because she in her mind believes they are related. Then the fifth time she acknowledges a bias is then going to the section two, which is, do you have any opinions or beliefs that would preclude you from following the court's instructions in this case? She was asked, would she follow the court's instructions and apply them to the evidence? And she said that she would. And then I asked the follow-up question, but would you be doing so through this lens of the bias that you have? And she said, yes, that's true. So she now has, for the fifth time, acknowledged that she is biased. In follow-up from defense counsel, this was never really addressed other than, will you do your best? I mean, I can't imagine any human being that's going to say they won't do their best. But will you do your best is not the question. The question has to be developed on setting aside your bias, setting aside your prejudices. And I think that is one of the important issues here, too, that the court has the opportunity to address, is it's different when someone's equivocal or ambivalent in their biases. They say they are, but they kind of hedge a little bit on it. But when somebody's confident, to have gone through your entire life, developed all your life experiences, and then say, I'm confident in my bias, and then through skillful questioning or an authoritarian figures in front of your neighbors and fellow potential jurors, to be asked questions about setting aside this bias, these people often flip. And they say, okay, I'll set aside my prejudices and my biases. And is that actually disingenuous for someone to give that response? I mean, I think they're doing what they feel pressured to do through artful questions.
But she also said here that she would do that she had heard good and bad. You know, didn't that rehabilitate her to some degree?
Well, she had heard good and bad, but she still said that she was confident in her bias.
But no, I think with that answer, that's when she said she would do her level best. That was questioned by defense counsel.
There's no doubt. I think she would do her level best. I think, this is taking it to the ultimate extreme, and I don't mean to be out of line here, but to take it to its ultimate extreme, I heard one really great lawyer once say, if you ask Heinrich Himmler if he thought he treated the Jews fairly, he would probably say, yeah, I think I did. Or would you do your level best, Mr. Himmler? Yeah, I sure will. But that's not the question. And also, that's why we don't let people judge, and the court has stated, you don't let people judge their own ability to be fair and impartial. It's not just what they say, but what their expressions were. And we have here her saying several things about 25 years of experience with Mercy. So it wasn't just, you know, her sister worked there for
Louis. But looking at the context, she's not the one who said, I'll do my best. She was asked, will you do your best? And she
yes.
said, yes, I've heard good and bad. I've heard both. And she, earlier she said good and bad, and yes, she would do her. She didn't say, I'll do my best too, which would sound equivocal. She was asked, would you do your best to put it aside? And she said, yes,
yeah.
I've heard good and bad. Why isn't that more than, saying it, I can set it aside, in effect?
I'm sorry.
Why isn't that like her? Isn't she saying, I can set it aside, I've heard good and bad, that she can be neutral?
No, because that was not as you've noted, Your Honor, that was not the question she was asked. She just asked, will she do her best?
Did she answer beyond that question? Will she do her level best to set it aside? And she said, yes, I've heard good and bad, I've heard both.
Yeah, that she'll do her best, and she's heard good and bad. But again, that brings up the other question. Those are very skillful questions asked by Mr. Bean. He's an excellent lawyer. And when you have people who are just common citizens of our state, and they say, I'm confident in my bias,
She didn't say it that way either, though. I mean, she didn't say, I'm confident in my bias, right?
She was confident in her answer that she would probably be in favor of the defendant. And when somebody states that, but then they're asked artful, skillful questions in front of their neighbors who have all said they will set aside any potential biases, I think there is pressure to say that, to answer that question, Your Honor. The other thing that I've noted in researching these cases is that almost all of them deal with Section 2. The prior cases this court has heard and has given opinions on, and at the appellate level as well, they tend to do with Section 2 biases, and those are ones where they're general biases. And I think general biases could rise to a level of a Section 1 bias, but they aren't developed. For example, in the Joy v. Morrison case or in the Patel case, which the defense brought out at the appellate level, those were questions about too many lawsuits. And in Patel, I believe the plaintiff's attorney felt that somebody should have been struck because they felt there were too many lawsuits. Well, we have to have a fair cross-section of society, and some people are going to have general biases. It's when do those ideological biases rise to a level that precludes the juror from following the court's instructions. I think one of the key problems that we see at the trial level, and I'm sure this case will address, but we see the mushing together of these two. There are people who just ask the question, will you be fair and impartial and follow the court's instructions? But really, they're two separate questions. There's the question of, will you set aside your biases or any prejudices to the extent you have them? And when someone says that they have a long history with a party litigant or party litigant via a relative, I think it is critical that for that person to be rehabilitated, that they not just be asked the artful question of, will you do what your fellow jurors here can all do, which is set aside these opinions and biases, but to develop why? If a person is really saying they have been rehabilitated, why have they gone through their entire life up to this moment and said that they're biased, and now 20 minutes later they flipped and said, no, I'm not biased anymore?
But isn't that why we give the trial judges lots of discretion here, because they've got the ability to see all that, not just the transcript?
Right, and that's one of the things the appellate courts have addressed, is that
it's abuse of discretion. We'd have to determine that in failing to strike this juror for cause, that it was just illogical for the trial judge to assume. Firmly against logic, I believe, is the way the standard's phrased.
And the court has stated before, I don't have the exact cite amongst all these, but the court has stated before that if the trial judge doesn't ask the follow-up questions, they waive, in a way, their right to be able to make that determination. If a juror says they're biased and the trial court doesn't ask the questions, then they've kind of relinquished that ability. But you're right, Your Honor, the cases have said that the trial court then has the ability, if not the obligation, if the defense counsel doesn't do it and the court wants to keep them on the juror, to ask the questions themselves. The judge can't ask those questions and rehabilitate the witness.
You are addressing a subject in this case of an implicit bias. And we've had lots of education in the judicial system about implicit bias, and we know that we all have implicit biases, and they're the harder tests, and we can all take them and find that we didn't have any idea we had an implicit bias. So if I take the Harvard test and find that I have an implicit bias based on race or ethnicity or gender or age that I didn't know I had, does that mean I am required to disqualify from all those cases?
I think as everyone, once you have the information and it comes to your knowledge, Your Honor, if you
then,
do have...
Then we're compelled to be aware of our biases and make sure that we don't use them in making our decision. But it's impossible for anyone not to have some kind of implicit bias. And the question is whether subparagraph 1 or subsection 1 you're referring to really means that someone can't have any kind of implicit bias, but it uses the language of forming or expressing an opinion concerning the matter or any material fact in the controversy in the case. Is that the same standard as having a possible implicit bias that you're aware of on some matter that may have some involvement in the case?
Your Honor, it's from reading the cases and from the statute itself, it's my understanding this has to be drawn out by the attorney and it has to be verbal.
Just what I'm asking is what she expressed a formed or expressed opinion concerning a matter or any material fact in controversy in the case? You say it is because you think it has something to do with her you say it could impact her determination of credibility. Is some potential bias that could impact credibility forming a matter concerning or a material fact in controversy in the case.
Yes, I believe it is, Your Honor, because she specifically states that she would probably start out in favor of the defendant in this particular case because of her knowledge and relationship with her sister who works at Mercy.
And do you have cases that support that interpretation of the language of the statute?
There are no Missouri cases that specifically address the Section 1 that bluntly, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Before you get into your argument, I'll ask you the same question. You argue that simply indicating that you have, I think the response was slight or a touch of bias in favor of one party. You argue that is not an opinion concerning a matter or material fact in controversy in the case. Do you have any case law that supports that position?
I think Joy supports that position, and I believe that Ray versus Green would support that position, the will contest case. And so I'm Ken Bean for Mercy. Thank you. This is a 9-day OB case, and we're down to one issue, as Mr. Bradshaw has told you. And that issue has two parts in my mind. The first part starts with the movement at trial must prove to the trial judge that there is a disqualifying bias under that statute. And as the court's already asked, the term bias doesn't appear in that statute, right? And you will also note that Mr. Bradshaw never asked that juror if she was biased. He asked her, would they start out slightly ahead? Never did he say to her what the impact of that would be on his case or how she listened to the evidence or whether she would follow the instructions. The touchstone of many of the cases will talk about prejudice, or it will talk about are you biased against. And if I can jump forward to the Joy case for only a moment. Joy is a case, malpractice case, where the juror said, I would be biased for the doctors, the defendants. And this court said, that's not enough. You haven't proved that bias is going to be biased against your client. And when a juror says in general, I like the defendants, if you will, which we hear all the time, and I hear all the time, I like the plaintiffs. And if that's enough to get a juror disqualified, then we're going to need three or four times the number of jurors we typically bring down to the courtroom, and we'll all ask,
Is that enough if they say they can't set that aside? Isn't that enough?
If they can set it aside, it is.
But if they cannot set it aside, if they say I'm biased for either side, and they say they cannot set that aside,
then that would be enough for disqualification.
But you're saying if they say...
Lots of jurors will say, and I've always thought that was the law, that I see jurors who say, quite frankly, Mr. Bean, one of my relatives died at your hospital. I'm not sure that I can be fair to your hospital. And I always would then follow up and say, okay, I understand how you start that. You understand that that's a different case, that your mother's case is different. And that's what the statute says, mm-hmm. The matter in controversy. Mm-hmm. You understand that's different? Yes, I understand it's different. And will you put that aside? No, I can't put that aside because it's going to influence the way I hear the evidence, which is part two of Section 1.
Are you reading an and between subparagraph 1 and subparagraph 2? That you have to find that they have formed or expressed an opinion and they won't follow the law?
No, I think it's either one in all honesty, Judge. I think you can have a Section 1 bias that you can say, I'll follow the instructions, but so my example would be, we've all read about the talc cases in the city of St. Louis. If some juror said, I have decided that talc causes ovarian cancer, but I'll follow the instructions, not enough. They have decided, they have expressed an opinion, which is what statute requires, they've expressed an opinion on the matter, a matter in controversy, an issue in controversy, and they're gone. Even though they can follow the instructions.
You're saying this is, if we're going to go in the Section 1, Section 2 lingo, this is really a Section 2 bias case because she was talking about generally she knows the nurses at these hospitals and she thinks they're, and so she would be slightly in their favor, but she didn't know anything about this case. So
correct.
One is not.
This is a 2, if anything, and she told Mr. Bradshaw and me, and the court obviously, mm-hmm. that she would follow the instructions.
She said she'd do her best.
Do her best.
Which is different. Would you agree with that?
Well, she told Mr. Bradshaw, when I went to the bench and said to the judge, I don't think he's got enough, I'm warning him.
Right.
His next question was, will you follow the jury instructions? Do your best to follow the jury instructions. He asked that question.
I understand that he asked that. But that was their answer. Let me ask you this. I read this transcript 2 or 3 times. Let me ask you this. If this is your best question and her best answer to your position that she was rehabilitated, you said you may be fair, but then you told us you would follow the instructions. So here's the question. Your sister's nurse, there are claims against nurses here. Can you put aside and assure the court that you will do your level best currently to decide this case based upon what you hear in this courtroom, not what your sister has told you, not anything about mercy, just on the evidence from that box and the judge's instructions? She says, yes, I've heard good and bad. I've heard both. Is that what you think is your best?
Yes, sir.
Rehabilitation question?
And I think that is rehabilitation.
Now, the Court of Appeals said that that it was your responsibility to examine her, to investigate the nature, the character, and the cause of her bias. Do you agree with that statement?
No, but I guess my response to that is I start with the burden on his side to prove the trial judge. But secondarily, what is it about what she said that would suggest a potential bias, right? She never said I'm biased. She said, I like mercy. I'm going to start out in favor of them. But it was all based upon her sister who worked at a different hospital in a burn unit. So my question asked those two components. Will you put aside what your sister has told you? Will you put aside what you know about mercy and decide this case with your level best efforts to decide what you hear today in this courtroom and the jury instructions? So I think my question, which was compact, and it's not in the record, but Mr. Bradshaw will confirm it, we were given 90 minutes for our voir dire, each side. So it's a compact question. I think that my question asked her the two issues that were driving her comments to him about, I think I'm slightly in favor of them because my sister works at a different Mercy hospital, and I've heard good and bad. And I would sort of turn the question. I'm always cognizant of the fact that I may be here one day in his shoes. So let's assume that I'm the one that at the end of the voir dire said to the judge, I want to strike that juror because she said she'd heard bad things about my client. I think Judge Wood would have looked at me and said, I'm sorry, Mr. Bean, no. And I think if I was asking you all to averse the 9-day trial, you would say, yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. Bean, no. She said good and bad. She said she would follow the instructions. She told Mr. Bradshaw in his first question, after she asked if they were related entities, he asked her if she would give more credibility to the defendants, and she said no. So when we talk about an opinion that all of us bring to the courtroom, we say, is that going to influence you? The piece about the influence, the piece about the opinion concerning the matter, or an opinion on a material fact in controversy, which may influence their judgment, was never established by Mr. Bradshaw. And I do think that what he did establish, that somebody's going to start off the line a little farther ahead, I fixed. So that's essentially where I put this case down. And it is an abuse of discretion standard here. It has to be something that, as the courts have said, shocks the sense of justice. There's the mere possibility of prejudice does not get you a new trial under Joy or Anglim or Anderson. And we don't take one answer. I mean, Mr. Bradshaw said she said 4 or 5 times. It's one answer we're dealing with here, right? And if you look at the totality here, she tells Mr. Bradshaw, I'm not going to give them more credibility. She tells me, I'm going to put aside what I hear from my sister and what I know about mercy. I'm going to do my level best to decide this case on what I hear and the instructions. She tells both of us she'll follow the instructions. He asks 4 general questions of the jurors. Who here won't hold the corporation liable for the conduct of the individual? Some people say, I don't understand that. You should have sued the doctors. Why are you suing the corporation? She didn't answer the question there. He asked, who's had a good experience with a doctor or hospital that's going to influence the way they hear this case? She didn't answer. He asked, you know, doctors often do their best efforts, but that can still be negligent. Is there somebody here that thinks if Dr. Glover did his best work that he can't be negligent? Didn't raise her hand. And finally, he asked, does anybody have any personal feelings about medical malpractice that would influence or influence their conduct here? No answer. So we're left with a juror who's given, in the totality, which we know we're supposed to consider, in the totality of it, has given several negative answers to any potential bias. She has never expressed an opinion, as Joy would say, about the matter in controversy, and as the will contest case would say. In the will contest case, jurors said, wow, you mean the decedent gave money to somebody that wasn't their blood relative? Yeah, I wouldn't do that. I can't imagine doing that. The juror said, I can't be fair. And then the judge said, but, you know, the law allows you to do that. You can give money to whoever you want in your will. And the court said, yeah, that's right. People come in with individual prejudices. They even express them at times, which she never did. She never expressed a prejudice or a bias. But the courts have said that's not enough. You have to meet the statutory content. And that statute, by the way, is 1989. So many of the cases cited by plaintiff predate the statute and don't even cite the statute. But that's what we're left with.
If we accept your premises or your argument, and someone in a veneer person in a criminal case says, I believe that police officers are more credible than other people, but gosh, I'll do my level best to follow the instructions. Then are we precluded from finding that veneer person should not serve?
You all sitting there, or the trial court? It's a little different, but
I get the differences. Yes.
I just want to do that first. Secondly, there are lots of cases that in fact involve that, criminal cases, and they've been cited by both of us in our briefs, where a juror says, my husband was a cop, and one of them said, he'd be very disappointed if I went home and said, I let this guy go home. And I'm thinking, oh yeah, you're gone. No question about it. Even if they said they could follow the instructions. I think the trial judge, and eventually this court, would have the duty to say, I got to think about what they really said here. What does it mean? Were they really fair? And I know I was
but
told.
But you're saying one of your responses tied it to this particular case. But if they didn't tie it to that particular case, your argument is that's not a opinion on a matter of material fact and controversy in the case. If they just say generally, I think police officers are more credible.
Well, I might try to draw a distinction between criminal and civil because we have the one case that came out of the Western District, I think, that said civil litigants aren't entitled to the fair panel before they do the peremptory strikes as criminal litigants. I might draw that distinction. But
the statute doesn't draw that one, though, does it?
The statute doesn't, but the Western District did about 10 years ago. I think I would say if all the jurors said is I like doctors or I like cops.
I think cops are more credible, maybe different than I like cops.
So if cops are more credible and there's going to be police officers testifying, then my answer is probably yes. That's a disqualifying standard under probably one. Because
and so you think saying I might be a touch or slightly in favor of the hospital is different than I think cops are more credible.
Yes, because she'd already told Mr. Bradshaw she would not give our clients more credibility.
She said, I don't think so.
I tend to
give them more credibility or that the defendant, maybe in this case, the local one start off, I don't think so.
Right. I agree. But that's for our trial judge to look at her demeanor and eyes and ears and all that kind of stuff, which we know from many, many cases. So I do think that Joy and Ray are the controlling decisions here. We did spend a ton of time in our briefs about the distinguishing, not distinguishing sections 1 and 2. My answer is there is no expressed opinion on the matter or a material fact that may influence her judgment under 1, and that even if we thought he got close to that, I believe my question cured it. And Mr. Bradshaw acknowledges in his brief that you can cure Section 1 problems with rehabilitation. She doesn't express some deep-seated belief. I think my questions addressed why she expressed that my client should start off slightly ahead. And she said I don't think it will impact my giving more credibility to the defense. We do think that there's a substantial risk that if this is sent back for retrial on this set of voir dire, it will lead to a significant extra time in the courtrooms, trial courtrooms, and a significant excess burdens on jurors because we'll have to bring back many, many more people. And we urge this court to affirm the judgment. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I don't like giving property to non-relatives. I don't think doctors should be sued so much. Those are general ideological beliefs. Those are Section 2. Mr. Bean has said this is a Section 2 case. That's not the case. This person had a specific life experience with Mercy. She had formed or expressed an opinion considering a matter or material fact in controversy.
But what was that fact that was in controversy?
Well,
her sister worked in the burn unit in a different Mercy hospital. So
we have an actual case against Mercy. I mean, it's the ultimate material.
But so if you had some general opinion about one of the parties, that's sufficient to come under 1? Distinguishing feature there?
If it rises to an expressed opinion concerning a matter in controversy, in this case.
But why is that a matter? I'm trying to get you to be more specific. I'm not saying you're right or wrong.
Okay.
But why is the defendant a matter in controversy? I mean, as opposed to a general opinion about, I like officers or I like cops generally, is that then a matter in controversy because you have a general opinion? I think the police department performs a good role in society, so I'd be slightly in their favor, but then you said, but I could set that aside. Why is that a Section 1 and not a Section 2?
That is an excellent question, and I think where the confusion comes, I think for the trial attorney, such as myself anyway, is that initially when we hear this Section 2 bias, which is an ideological bias such as, in civil cases, preponderance of the evidence, when we hear this, preponderance of the evidence is too low. It has to be more the clear and convincing standard. We're not going to follow that instruction. Or if a doctor did his best, so what if he didn't follow the standard of care? The doctor did his best. I'm not going to find against a doctor who's doing his best. So they're not following the instruction. And I think that is much different than when someone says, I am so in love, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but I'm so in love with Mercy, I'm now going to be in favor of Mercy. They're now expressing an opinion regarding an actual material matter in controversy, which is found liable?
What is the material fact in controversy there? Mercy is not a fact in controversy.
The fact in controversy is whether the individuals working for Mercy, whose acts of negligence we are alleging, were negligent and caused harm.
And how does that have anything to do with that fact?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
How is anything this veneer person said related in any way to an opinion, a formed or expressed opinion about what you just said? The conduct of this doctor with respect to this patient and the harm that did or didn't ensue.
Because she will be in favor of this particular defendant in this particular case.
Why is that a Section 1, not a Section 2, since you're drawing a big distinction between those? Why isn't that a general, more amorphous bias or viewpoint as opposed to something about the facts and controversy or the matter in controversy?
Because under Section 1, and it also goes on when read in context with if relationship to the party or consanguinity or relationship to a prosecuting attorney or that type of matter, you have an actual case where the alleged negligence of Mercy Hospital and what they have done in not performing the C-section is the matter in controversy. And she stated that she would be in favor of Mercy in this matter because of her relationship with her sister over 25 years of working with that burn unit.
You treat it basically as her saying she would be slightly in favor of Mercy, meaning she'd be less likely to find they're negligent.
Correct.
Implicit in what she said.
Correct, Your Honor. Thank you. Yes, that's exactly what I'm trying to say.
Okay. Thank you. Your time is up.
Thank you.
The matter will be...
But always well spent if you're answering a judge's question.
Thank you both.
Thank you.